Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The buzz yesterday was that Goldman Sachs was set to announce a $2 billion profit. As often happens, though, the buzz could not have been more wrong. Missed the actual number by a mile. Goldman made almost $3.5 billion last quarter. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 14th of July. One would expect the world's most successful investment bank to be resourceful, able to find the diamonds in a very rough economy. And resourceful Goldman Sachs has been. $3.3 billion in profit last quarter, resourceful. In a way, though, it's exactly what was supposed to happen once the government decided on a bailout last year. Washington wanted banks to start making money again. Another way to look at it, though, is that it might be to see Goldman as a company profiting from a crisis it helped create. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
It turns out what happens when the financial system crashes is a lot like what happens when a computer program crashes. Who are you going to call? You're likely to end up paying the same people you're cursing for the technical support to maneuver your way out of the mess. As Manhattan College finance professor Charles Geist sees it, that's what's behind all the money Goldman Sachs is raking in now.
They have a reputation for hiring the best and the brightest people on Wall Street. And when times like this arise and the crunch comes, one needs that sort of expertise to dig one's way out. So in other words, they find themselves on all sides of the market and all sides of the crisis, and they're benefiting from it.
Businesses have been flocking to Goldman for loans and for help issuing stock to raise much-needed funding. And the firm's high-tech split-second trading systems have made a fortune. It's been able to cash in on volatility in oil and other commodities and the stock market. Geist finds irony in Goldman's fast footwork paying back the rescue money it got from the government's troubled asset relief program. That means taxpayers aren't seeing much benefit from their $10 billion largesse.
It's sort of difficult to say whether or not the TARP money actually provided the capital that they needed for these activities. My guess is yes, it did.
Geist says Goldman's rivals are either gone or still struggling to compete on the same level, but it probably won't continue to have the field and the profits mostly to itself much longer. Goldman's chief financial officer, David Vinier, conceded as much during a conference call with analysts today.
I think some part of it is sustainable and some part of it is not. Over time, you know, firms will recover, firms will be willing to provide more risk capital, and, you know, it's going to happen over time. It'll drive spreads narrower.
For now, though, Goldman is enjoying a very profitable financial crisis. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The House held up its end of the health care debate today. Speaker Nancy Pelosi released a 1,000-page, trillion-dollar overhaul package this afternoon.
We're still on schedule to do what we have planned, to vote on this legislation before we leave for the August recess.
I think somebody needs to check with the Senate on that timeline. We called the cloakroom this afternoon. They have got just 18 working days, the Senate does, before they go on summer vacation. During a speech in Michigan today, President Obama played a little bit of economic hardball. He said some of the jobs that Detroit and other cities have lost in this recession just aren't going to be coming back. Part of how he wants us to deal with that is through education, community college education to be specific. The White House wants to dramatically increase the number of students completing degrees at two-year schools at a time when a lot of those schools are already struggling to keep up with demand. From Washington, Tamara Keith has more.
Say you've been laid off and you keep hearing that healthcare jobs are where it's at. A nursing degree from the local community college could be the answer, if you can wait.
Every college in Michigan offers nursing, and everyone has a waiting list.
Mike Hansen is president of the Michigan Community College Association.
Just because you want to become a nurse doesn't mean you can, you know, walk right in and sign up to be a nurse.
Community college enrollment always spikes during tough economic times. People come looking to retrain and find a new career, and an increasing number of high school grads are turning to community colleges to save on university tuition. There's just one problem. Hansen says college budgets aren't growing. Actually, they're shrinking.
You're trying to serve more students in a time of need, in a time of declining revenue, to support those students.
In Washington state, funding cuts are so severe the Community College Board declared a financial state of emergency for the first time since 1982. In California, more than 200,000 students may not be able to attend classes due to budget cuts combined with booming enrollment. Scott Lay with the Community College League of California says it's down to survival of the fittest.
Those students who have the ability to wait on a waiting list, to stand in line to see a counselor, are the ones that are surviving and getting into classes. Unfortunately for the economically neediest students, they just have a real hard time competing to get the classes they need.
College leaders say they appreciate the president's attention, and they'll take any extra money they can get. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
It has been less than a week, 4 days in fact, that the new General Motors has been out of bankruptcy. But the company is starting to look a lot like the old GM. CEO Fritz Henderson said last Friday he's going to build 10 new models over the next year and a half. That gives GM almost as many models on the road as it had before it went bust. And just yesterday, a bankruptcy judge said GM can buy back parts of its old supplier, Delphi. That would be the same Delphi that GM dumped back in the late 1990s. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now on GM Lite.
The new GM is meant to be smaller than the old. Instead of 72 different vehicles, there'll be only 34. It's also planning to roll out 10 new cars before the end of next year. Susan Dougherty's a VP at GM. She was showing reporters the latest version of Buick's luxury sedan, the LaCrosse, today. She called me from the passenger seat.
The best way to signify that our company is going to get back on track and be healthy is to introduce just a plethora of new product.
She doesn't think the company's introducing too many new vehicles. Bruce Belzowski studies the car business at the University of Michigan. He says the numbers don't matter. It's whether people buy them. He says with this expansion and hiring moves, it's easy to see why people might think the new GM is just more of the same old.
When you hear about GM hiring back executives who are supposed to be retiring, that can make people a little nervous about, are you going back to the old days?
That would be Bob Lutz he's talking about, a 77-year-old exec who retired in April and just got hired back to run marketing. GM's also set to buy back some of the troubled parts maker Delphi, which it spun off years ago. But that's not such a bad idea. John Paul McDuffie is a professor at Wharton. He says Delphi is still a major supplier to GM, and investing in the supply chain is the safest way to guarantee it.
And if the suppliers are very weak, that will make it tougher for GM to have the comeback it hopes to have.
But then again, if people don't start buying cars again, there won't be a comeback for anyone in the business. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
This morning's Goldman profit announcement was all over the rumor mill yesterday, so there really wasn't much buying on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The U.S. was in Vietnam for more than a decade, Iraq for 6 years so far. The war on drugs, though, has been going on for four decades. 40 years ago today, President Nixon asked Congress to create a national anti-drug policy. It became the war on drugs in this speech 2 years later.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
Since then, best guesses are we've spent more than $500 billion trying to get drugs off American streets. Ben Wallace Wells is the national affairs correspondent for Rolling Stone. He covers the drug war for the magazine. Ben, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
What was going on that President Nixon felt the need to make that speech and make this announcement?
Vietnam was going on. There were all of these reports that were beginning to filter back from Southeast Asia that said American soldiers were developing very, very bad heroin and marijuana problems. And there grew out of that a sense that a kind of public health emergency was in the offing. When these troops returned to the U.S., they'd bring addictions back with them.
And from that, we have the Drug Enforcement Administration. We have the Office of National Drug Control Policy, the Drug Czar's Office. We have, according to things you've written, $500 billion spent in the last 40 years. Are we winning the war on drugs?
It's hard to make the case we're winning. I'd also argue that you need a different metaphor. The way to think about this is not a battle against an opponent that we can beat or not. The drug war is a kind of running index of human misery that, you know, the government has some not negligible ability to impact if it chooses its policies wisely. The problem that a lot of critics have is that we haven't always chosen our policies very wisely.
But there have been successes. I mean, if you go back to the late 80s, early 90s and the days of Pablo Escobar, I mean, you know, we tracked him down, we got him, and the DEA was riding high.
That's sort of the moment that represents the greatest opportunity that we've had in the history of the drug war. By the early 90s, not only had we managed to kill Escobar, but the social scientists who were looking at drug policy in the drug war had begun to come up with some pretty interesting and pretty wise suggestions about how we might better allocate our funds and how we might sort of reduce that kind of human misery we've been talking about.
What did they come up with, these social scientists, in terms of how to fight this problem, this enemy?
People who look at the drug war tend to group policies into two categories: the supply of drugs coming into the country, and then the other side is programs like treatment and prevention that try to reduce demand, try to reduce the market for illegal drugs in this country. What they've found sort of consistently over the last 15 years is that, crudely, we need to spend more on demand-side programs and less on supply-side programs.
And in fact, we do spend most of our money on the supply side, right?
We spend about two-thirds on buying, you know, fun toys for the Mexican and Colombian militaries and other measures, and that's a number that's been rising.
And this whole question of drugs and what to do about it is so freighted. It's got questions of social justice and prison policy and just say no. I mean, is there a way to agree on how to figure out if we're doing well or poorly?
I think there is. I mean, we can measure success by how much we are able to affect the supply of drugs coming into the country, how much we're able to reduce the consequences of serious drug use, and how much we're able to cut down on the amount of drugs that are being used in the country. And the problem is that the recommendations that have evolved from that have never really been paid much attention to.
So what do we do? I mean, if you look back 15 years, why don't we try to look forward 15 years and think about what this war on drugs might look like then?
We can make marginal improvements, you know, and we know that if you take addicts and you put them through rehabilitation programs, you know, 10%, 12% of them will go from using drugs very regularly, using cocaine, using heroin very regularly, to not using cocaine and heroin very regularly. And that's a real improvement. And so I think over time, I think that we can at least hope that if we do apply the science here, that we can begin to make a dent.
Ben Wallace Wells from Rolling Stone magazine. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
For all the federal government has been throwing at this recession, stimulus plans, interest rate cuts, new rules and regulations, most of it seems like stuff straight out of the standard economic playbook, just more of it. Commentator Casey Cole says once a problem gets as big as this one has, the best answer isn't always more of the same.
By now, it should be obvious that the current financial meltdown is not just bigger than previous downturns. It's qualitatively different. Most people think that quantity and quality are two different things, but fundamentally, they're not. So it's not really that surprising that big numbers of bad bets turned seemingly rock-solid investments into something more like quicksand. Take an everyday example, like boiling a pot of water for your pasta. You add more and more heat, and for a while, well, you just get hotter water. But suddenly the water boils, then turns to vapor, a different state of matter altogether, one far more volatile and hard to keep a lid on. Physicists call such properties emergent because they only emerge when there's enough of something. A few neurons can't make a mind, but put enough together and we seem to get consciousness. The number of electrons buzzing around atoms determines whether something is sweet, stinky, acid, or blue. There's nothing in our universe shaped like a teacup the size of Jupiter, because when things get big enough, gravity crushes matter into spheres or disks. If a star gets really big, say bigger even than George Clooney, several times the mass of the sun, the gravity of its sheer size will eventually cause it to implode, leaving nothing but a gaping hole in space-time, a black hole, a one-way street to oblivion. At a certain point, size is all that matters. It's the same with the economy. Treating the current collapse as just a bigger version of what's gone before won't work because so many bits of bad news have plunged us into a different kind of hell. Consider this. The boiling water in your pot can be dumped down the sink, but once it's turned to vapor, good luck getting it off the walls. Qualitatively different situations call for qualitatively different solutions.
Casey Cole is a professor at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Southern California. Take a minute, send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, why French food is not so fancy anymore.
France has lost that exceptionalism, I guess you could say. It's no longer the place one has to go to eat well.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials pushed up a third of 1%, 27 points, closed at 8,359 today. The NASDAQ also rose a third of 1%, 6 points, ended at 1799. The S&P 500 added a half percent, 4 points, finished the session at 905. Pay no attention to that music. CIT, the big lender to small business that we told you about yesterday, banked more than 19% on news the government might give it some help to stay afloat. Railroad stocks were back on track. CSX rolled up nearly 7%. Then after reporting better-than-expected quarterly earnings yesterday, Norfolk Southern and Union Pacific were both up almost 4% today. Giant chipmaker Intel picked up 9% in after-hours trading. Its quarterly earnings blew past Wall Street's expectations. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at elance.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly Consumer Price Index, letting us know how much folks in urban areas are paying for goods. The Federal Reserve Board reports on industrial production for June. And a House committee discusses how to preserve subsidized housing so low-income, elderly, and disabled tenants are not displaced. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Inflation watchers, like, I don't know, say a guy named Ben Bernanke, they got a poke in the ribs today from the Commerce Department. Wholesale prices jumped close to 2% last month, mostly thanks to rising energy prices. Typically, though, inflation is one of the few things you don't have to worry about during a recession. Prices tend to go the other way in a down economy. And when you look back over the past year or so, we have actually been paying a little bit less for most things. So why are people nervous still about inflation? Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
It's not just inflation some people are talking about, but hyperinflation. Price increases of 100, 1,000, even 1,000,000% a year or more. The word conjures images of Germans carting around wheelbarrows of cash in the 1920s. To get a sense of what life might be like with those kinds of runaway prices, I spoke to Isaac Cohen. He's an economist formerly with the United Nations. He lived in Mexico in the 1980s during a period of rampant inflation throughout Latin America.
Prices were being changed in the supermarkets in front of you every hour. So you would go to the supermarket, buy cooking oil for, let's say, 50 pesos And an hour later, it would be 80 pesos or 100 pesos. It would double, you know, in an hour.
Cohen says bills would almost disintegrate in your hand from overuse.
You need to have a lot of cash in your pocket because what you want to do is you want to get rid of it as fast as possible. Go buy yourself a refrigerator, buy yourself a car, something durable, you know, to compensate for the loss of value of the currency.
So is that what we're in for? Are we all going to have to sink our money into major appliances? I asked Andy Rosenfield over at Guggenheim Partners. He advises institutions and rich people on how to invest their money. He says some of those clients are very worried about inflation. Not that we should break out the wheelbarrows anytime soon, but Rosenfield says we could be in for a lot more than the 2 to 3% annual inflation we're used to.
It's very likely that we could experience a material inflation in the United States. Perhaps 5, 10, even 12% rates of increase in price. That's something we haven't seen since the Carter administration in the United States.
Rosenfield says it'll be a few years before higher prices start to bite. If they do, John Brynjolfsson will be poised to profit. He started the hedge fund Armored Wolf this year, in part to capitalize on what he sees as the coming wave of inflation. Brynjolfsson says the Fed is pouring dollars into the economy to try to stave off a deeper recession. When too much money chases too few goods, prices rise.
The Fed and Ben Bernanke have the printing press, they have the ink, they have the paper, and therefore they control the value of money.
To stop prices from rising too high too fast, they can slow or stop the printing press. But economist Barry Bosworth with the Brookings Institution says they shouldn't do it too soon. He says all this talk of inflation is a distraction from the real problem. Close to 10% of eligible workers are unemployed.
In the Great Depression of the 1930s, we had this same sort of talk. So-called monetary experts warned about inflation. The central bank got worried, and it literally tightened up on monetary policy in 1937 and caused a return to the Depression. The economy collapsed all over again. So we don't want to act prematurely.
Bosworth says he'd actually welcome a little inflation, maybe 2 or 3%. It would be a sign that the economy has enough momentum to pull out of the recession. The art is knowing when to put the brakes on before inflation runs out of control. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today is Bastille Day, the 14th of July. It's a major French holiday. If you're of a mind to, and if you know a good French restaurant nearby, perhaps you'll celebrate with some steak frites and a nice bottle of Chateau Neuf du Pape. Revelers actually in France, however, might want to think twice before they dine out. Author Michael Steinberg is worried you'll be disappointed. From bread and cheese to bouillabaisse, he says French cuisine isn't quite what it used to be. And he says it in his new book, Au Revoir to All That. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
How do you know, Michael, that French cuisine is not as good as it used to be?
You can see it in all sorts of ways. You see thousands of cafes, bistros, and brasseries disappearing every year. France is losing 30,000 farms a year. Wine, another iconic part of French cuisine. Wine consumption in France has declined more than 50% over the last 40 years and continues to plummet.
What the heck happened then? I mean, if a whole country's cuisine is less good than it used to be, what's going on?
Well, a couple things. Complacency, for one. They've been the kings of cuisine for hundreds of years, and it's natural to get a little complacent when you've been the unsurpassed kings for so long. But the biggest factor is economic. You've had basically 30 years of economic stagnation in France, and French cuisine has stagnated as a result. It's not an ideological or political argument. You've had governments of both the left and right, and all have served up the same toxic stew: anemic growth, high unemployment, stagnant wages and living standards, and crippling levels of taxation and regulation. And that has really hurt the culinary arts in France.
Is that a long way of saying cheap? Consumers in France, and hence maybe the rest of the world, are looking for a cheaper, faster, easier meal than the time it takes to really do it right?
Well, that's certainly become an imperative for many people in France, with living standards for many being so stagnant. People have had to economize on what they eat and drink. They've gravitated to hypermarkets, the big supermarkets that are much more cost-effective, serve but offer much cheaper food by and large than those glorious outdoor markets that we associate with France. And in terms of eating out, they've gravitated in many cases to fast food, not least McDonald's. France is now the second most profitable market in the world for McDonald's.
Is there an element here of the rise of the rest that other countries and other nationalities are getting better at food and taking more care, and then the French sort of suffer by comparison?
That's a big part of it. We eat much better here in the U.S. than we did 20 or 30 years ago. It's true in Britain. It's true in many places. And so France has lost that exceptionalism, I guess you could say. It's no longer the place one has to go to eat well. And in fact, in the last 10, 15 years, as far as haute cuisine goes, as far as cuisine at the highest levels goes, it's Spain that has really become the culinary lodestar.
That must just kill the French that the Spanish are good at food now. But the only thing worse would be like if the Brits were better at food.
I think it does grate at them quite a bit. I'm not sure, you've got the Spanish now getting all the attention. You've had great food happening in Britain. In fact, talk about insulting the French. Gourmet magazine a few years ago named London the most exciting food city in the world. So, yeah, I think all these things are very damaging to the French psyche, perhaps. And the idea of an American writing about the decline of French cuisine, probably more salt in the wound.
That's right. What about the future, though, Michael? I mean, economics aside, are you hopeful about French cuisine?
I am cautiously optimistic that there'll be a recovery here. You see, for instance, a very promising movement in Paris. It's even got a name now called Bistronomy. Young, extremely talented chefs who 20, 30 years ago would have been considered shoo-ins for three Michelin stars, would have risen to the pinnacle of the profession. They've decided to do something very different. Instead of opening luxury palaces, they've opened casual bistros, oftentimes in less posh parts of Paris, serving glorious food, but in a much more casual setting and at a price many more people can afford. And that's a really encouraging sign.
Michael Steinberger is a wine columnist for Slate. His book on the decline and fall of French cuisine is called Au Revoir to All That. Michael, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, orange may well be passé. That's the threat level we've been at for more than 3 years, in case you'd forgotten somehow. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano announced this afternoon she's reconsidering the multicolored terror alert system. Napolitano said she doesn't much care what system her review board does come up with, so long as it's more effective than the colors. That green is good, red is bad system has never been all that popular with the traveling public or with Congress, for that matter. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow hiked up 27 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 6 points, also a third percent. The S&P 500 tacked on 4 points. That's about a half percent. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this radio broadcast, winds of change in the renewable energy market.
The current policy environment is much more stable than it has ever been in the past. And so it's attracting enormous interest from foreign players at this point.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.